what you say. Good morning. It's still morning. I'm going to talk today about some research that we've been doing at the University of Virginia on the impact of the needlestick safety legislation on. Today we're talking about the impact on hospital nurse injuries, and I just wanted to acknowledge my co-investigators, Janine Jaeger, the director of our center, Ginger Parker, who handles our data, and Mark Conaway, who's our wonderful biostatistician. So in terms of disclaimers, the authors have no personal financial relationships, but I do want to mention that over the years we have a lot of medical device companies, probably 25 companies, who continue to help support our work at the center. I want to just say a couple words about the Exposure Prevention Information Network, EpiNet. It's a surveillance system that was developed at the University of Virginia in the early 1990s, and it tracks sharps injuries and blood exposures, providing information about who gets exposed and stuck and how that happens. And since 1993, a subset of EpiNet users, 85 hospitals across 10 states, have voluntarily sent us their data, and it's that information that's behind the tables that I'll show you in my presentation. And so the nurses that I refer to this morning are all hospital nurses. The data are useful within each hospital to create safer environments and to promote safe practices, and it helps hospitals to understand their problems and to make corrections or interventions. But for our purposes, we're really interested in looking on a larger scale in order to improve things in a bigger way, and that often involves creating policy. This chart reflects the U.S. EpiNet data over 15 years, and nurses account for the greatest percentage of all reported injuries from sharp devices. And I'll tell you that we find this is true around the world every place we go, and in part it's because nurses are often the largest number of job by job categories, the largest numbers. And so this doesn't really reflect rates by job category, but in terms of the number of injuries, nurses are often the largest group by far around the world. And it's one of the reasons that we wanted to focus specifically on nurse injuries. One of the things that we know is that healthcare workers make a decision at the time that they get an injury. They make a decision about risk. They think to themselves, how risky is this injury? Is the patient a high-risk patient for a bloodborne pathogen? Was there visible blood at the site of the injury? If so, how much? And based on their consideration, then they decide whether or not to report it. And, of course, all we can report on is what's reported in the data. So we know for sure that our numbers and rates are underestimates of real true injuries, but we do think that the highest risk injuries are those that are most likely to be reported, at least in the U.S. Our early work and the work of Congress members and union leaders and medical device manufacturers, administrators, professional organizations, nurses, and others culminated in the signing of the Needlestick Safety and Prevention Act of 2000, H.R. 5178. And our center director, Janine Jaeger, is right over President Clinton's right shoulder, smiling broadly, because we and many, many others that I mentioned had worked for a long time in trying to get this legislation passed. And, in fact, our workers in the units the United States are among the safest in the world. The law mandated some revisions to OSHA's bloodborne pathogen standard, and here's what's changed according to this law. Exposure control plans had to document the identification, evaluation, and selection of new safety devices that were coming to the market, and cost was no longer an acceptable reason for a facility or an institution not to purchase safety devices. Employers had to solicit and document input from workers who actually cared for patients. These are frontline workers, and they had to have input in terms of the devices that were being purchased. It couldn't just be a decision of the procurement or purchasing department. So this was a great opportunity then for nurse advocacy, because nurses have always understood the risks that they were under associated with caregiving, but now they had the opportunity to affect that environment in which they worked and to help identify tools that would help protect them and allow them to give care with the least risk to themselves. The law also said that organizations had to keep formal records of sharps injuries, including designated categories. And for many hospitals, the system that they used was the EpiNet system. There were terms that were defined in the legislation, and these terms had been sort of used for a long time, but they didn't mean the same thing to everybody, and so now the legislation actually defined some of these terms. It defined safety-engineered devices and said they were effective and mandated their use. It defined sharps with safety-engineered protection that included non-needle systems as well as those that had a safety mechanism attached. It defined needleless systems, such as ports that didn't require any sharp connector or jet injection systems. These were defined as part of the safety arsenal available. So what happened? Did the law make any difference? Well, here you see that the overall percutaneous injury rate among nurses over the 10-year period, 5 years before and 5 years after the legislation, came down significantly. I want to just mention briefly that we had to estimate the denominator, the nursing denominator, because we get reports about FTEs but not specific job categories. So in one institution, you could look at individual job rates. So we estimated based on lots of different estimates by professional organizations and nursing organizations, Department of Labor, and we settled on 30% of all FTEs, and that's our denominator. The rates dropped about 40% in the year after the legislation, and while that's pretty impressive, I should mention that overall IV catheter and phlebotomy injuries dropped by more than half. The reason that that's so important is because those are the highest risk injuries because there's a larger quantity of blood filling those devices. One of our frustrations, which I alluded to a second ago, is that we don't have good denominators for all the questions we'd like to ask. So often we looked at shifts in the proportion of injuries in order to get a sense about how the pattern of injuries is changing. This graph compares the percentage of percutaneous injuries of nurses, which is the black bar, with injuries to others, which is the striped bar. And I want to mention again, all groups saw decreases in injuries after the legislation, so this is only a proportionate shift. The reason we're looking at that is that if all groups saw the same rate of decrease, then the bars would remain straight across that 10-year period. And when they don't, it indicates to us a change in the patterns of those injuries. So what we see here is that the proportion of injuries incurred by nurses is decreasing, and that suggests that their rate decreased at a faster rate than other groups. Again, this is a proportionate shift, and it tells us whether decreases in nurse injuries occur differently depending on when in the use disposal cycle nurses got injured. We see that the smallest proportion of injuries, and these are the little tiny hatch marks down below, these are injuries that occurred before the device was used, and these decrease some, but consistently they're a tiny portion of all injuries. I want to talk about that just for a second, because if workers actually do make an assessment of risk when they get injured, the chances of getting infection from a device that hasn't been used yet is pretty tiny, and so I think that those are probably the injuries that are least likely to be reported as well. So we don't put a lot of weight on those injuries. But where we do see the big shift is injuries after use, and that's the striped bar. You see the proportion of injuries decreasing in comparison to the injuries during use, which is the black bar, and we see the proportion of injuries increasing over that period of time. And we think that this after-use decrease might be a function of a couple things. One is a better location of disposal devices, that now that they're right at the point of use, you don't have to, for those of us who've been around a long time, you don't stick a sharp device in your pocket and walk down to the nurse's station to dispose of it. So that helps to reduce the after-use. Also, that we have better puncture-resistant disposal containers, and so you're not sticking sharps in Dixie cups, which we used to do. The other thing is that safety-engineered devices, for a large part, typically protect the worker from being injured from the sharp after use, not during use. So I think that accounts for why we're seeing that shift in patterns. This figure looks at the shift in the location in the hospital where nurses got injured. Historically, you probably know, patient rooms were the area where we saw the most frequent injuries to nurses, right in the patient rooms. And the injury rates for nurses in patients' room did drop by about a third. But again, here we're looking at the proportions. So even if all areas show decreasing rates, did the pattern shift? So the first bar, which is your hatch marks, is patients' rooms, and it's where we see the biggest shift. We see a decreasing proportion before the legislation, followed by an increasing proportion afterwards. Well, what's up with that? What we think this reflects is a couple things. One is some of the things we talked about in terms of disposal, and also that the early use of injection and syringes in the room. So we begin to see a decreased proportion in the rooms. But then afterwards, we think that what happened is that more procedures were being done right in the patient room, so we weren't moving patients to the OR or to procedure rooms. And any place that you're using sharp devices, you're going to see injuries. And so as we began to see more things happening in the patient rooms, I think that that may account for some, for that increased proportion. So what do we make of all this? Well, there appears to be a significant positive effect of the legislation on overall nursing injury rates. The effect on nurses appears to be greater than the overall effect on decreased injuries. The injuries occurring after use of a sharp device decreased faster than overall injuries. And the proportion of injuries that occurred in patient rooms saw some decrease and then an increase after the legislation. So what else needs to be done? What's next? Well, first, I would say we have to continue to examine how nurses continue to be injured. We're not down to zero, and frankly, I think as long as we use any sharp device, no matter the safety mechanism, we're not going to get to zero. But I think we can do better than we're doing, so we want to continue to look at how nurses continue to be injured. Where are the opportunities to intervene so that their work can be done more safely and at less risk? Second, I think we need to consider how we're educating healthcare students and those already practicing, and I would say that's true for nurses and others. How do we educate about the prevention of sharp injuries? I think there's very little education done in schools, and oftentimes in a facility, there's an orientation at the point that the worker starts, and then that's it. And so I think that addressing it only once, whether during student training or orientation, I think is not sufficient. We have new workers coming in all the time, and also new devices are coming onto the market all the time. And I think that if it's not reinforced, people will forget what they've learned. And so I think it needs to be an ongoing educational program. Others have mentioned this before, and I would agree that nationally the focus has been very heavy on hospitals, and that's where we see the most injuries reported. But while we need to continue to improve that environment, I think we also need to focus on healthcare worker safety for injuries and exposures among workers in nursing homes, in patient homes, and other non-hospital sites, including education for patients in home who take care of themselves because those sharp devices are disposed of all over town. I think that the healthcare workers in these environments not only have need for safety from bloodborne pathogens, but also, and many people don't realize this, they are covered under the Needle Stick Safety and Prevention Act, and they are covered under the OSHA guidelines standards that any place where workers have, through the normal course of their job, have the risk of being exposed and being injured are covered under this law. I think that the non-hospital venues, they'll need safety engineered devices and disposal products, and perhaps they need to be modified some or newly developed for use in those situations. We'll need education and training for workers as well as the patients who provide their own self-care. Fourth, I think we need to identify the procedures and devices for which there are still no safety alternatives and help the medical device industry begin to make those safer as well. So how do we know what devices we don't have? Well, healthcare workers know when they have to use a conventional device because there's no safety equivalent. And so that knowledge is critical, and somehow it needs to be shared with the medical device company. And lastly, I think we need to consider how what we've learned in the most developed countries can translate to poorer countries. There are practices and protective equipment that cost little or nothing, things like hands-free neutral passing of sharp devices or recycling disposal containers that are already in the environment rather than using cardboard boxes. So I think there's much that we can do. So although we have seen some success in protecting workers in the U.S., I think it's important to think about both here and abroad. And I think nurses, and I would say especially perhaps occupational health nurses, we're very focused on protecting our patients and our workers rather than ourselves sometimes, and I think that we need to remember that we also remain at risk for injury and infection, and our findings suggest that there's still some work to do, even though we've had some progress, in order to protect ourselves and our colleagues who put their lives on the line every day, everywhere. Thank you.
Thank you, Elaine. We have time for a couple of questions, if there are any. Linda?
Linda Hill, PCLA Loge. Thank you very much. I was curious about the data collection. If you could raise in particular two questions, one related to why it's difficult to really know what the denominator is, maybe related to that, the question of job classification. And especially the latter, it seems like it should be a fairly simple fix in terms of reporting, but what are the issues?
Yeah, the issue is really one of denominators. We do ask job classification in terms of who's injured. So we know how many injuries by job classification, and that's the pie chart that I showed. The problem is we don't know for every hospital how many nurses do they have in their hospital, how many physicians, how many physical therapists, how many lab technologists. That's where we have problems talking about rates where within a given institution they wouldn't have that same kind of problem. So That's frustrating for us, but we don't have it. And the data that we used, I mean, in the past what we've used is beds, and there's lots of problems with using beds, but that's what the hospitals report to us. So for this study, we actually went to the AHA annual reports and manually extracted the FTEs for each hospital, but that was the best we could do. So I share your frustration, but did that answer your question? Do you have a second question?
Yeah, I was
Yeah, they can tell us how many are working, but they don't give us the breakdown by job category. Yeah.